Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 12. Dhruva Maharaj goes back to Godhead. Today we're reading text 31, which doesn't have a purport, and then we'll chant together text 32. So text 31. Chada dundu bayo ne dur mridango panavadayaha. Gandharva mukya prajagu petu kusama vrishtayaha. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. At that time, drums and kettle drums were sounded from the sky. The chief Gandharvas began to sing, and other demigods showered flowers like torrents of rain upon Dhruva Maharaj. So please repeat. Sa cha svarloka Arokshan Sunitim Jananim Dhruvaha Anvasmarad Agam Hitva Dinam Yasye Trivishtapam Sacha Svarlokam Arokshan Sunitim Jananim Dhruvaha Anvasmaradagam Hitva Dinam Yasye Trivishtapam Sachasvarlokam Arokshan Sunitim Jananim Dhruvaha Anvasmaradagam Hitva Dinam Yasye Trivishtapam Sachasvarlokam Arokshan Sunitim Jananim Dhruvaha Anvasmaradagam Hitva Dinam Yasye Trivishtapam
Sunitim Jalavim Juva Yasaragam Hitpa Dinam Yasya Trivishtipa Sacha Svarloka Maroksha Sunyam Jatsam Juva.
Third line. Vaishnavis. Sacha svarlokam arokshan.
Nitim Jalanim Java Anvismar Adagam Hidva Dinam Yasye Trivishtipam Sachasva Loka Maroksha Yuchitra Kremriva Vacharada Chamlukam Sa, he. Cha, also. Svalokan, to the celestial planet. Arokshan, about to ascend. Sunitim, suniti. Jananim, mother. Andruvaha, Dhruva Maharaj. Anvasmarat. Immediately remembered. Agam. Difficult to attain. Hitva. Leaving behind. Dinam. Poor. Yasye. I shall go. Trivishtapam. To the Vaikuntha planet. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. So, please repeat the translation. Dhruva was seated in the transcendental airplane, which was just about to start, when he remembered his poor mother, Suniti. He thought to himself, how shall I go alone to the Vaikuntha planet and leave behind my poor mother? Purport. Dhruva had a feeling of obligation to his mother, Suniti. It was Suniti who had given him the clue which had now enabled him to be personally carried to the Vaikuntha planet by the associates of Lord Vishnu. He now remembered her and wanted to take her with him. Actually, Dhruva Maharaja's mother, Suniti, was the Patta Pradarshika Guru. Patta Pradarshika Guru means the guru who shows the guru, or the spiritual master who shows the way. Such a guru is sometimes called Shiksha Guru. Although Narada Muni was his Diksha Guru, initiating spiritual master, Suniti, his mother, was the first who gave him instruction how to achieve the favor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is the duty of the Shiksha Guru or Diksha Guru to instruct the disciple in the right way, and it depends on the disciple to execute the process. According to Shastric injunction, there is no difference between Shiksha Guru and Diksha Guru, and generally the Shiksha Guru later on becomes the Diksha Guru. Suniti, however, being a woman, and especially his mother, could not become Dhruva Maharaja's Diksha Guru. Still, he was not less obliged to Suniti. There was no question of carrying Narada Muni to Vaikuntha Loka, but Dhruva Maharaj thought of his mother. Whatever plan the Supreme Personality of Godhead contemplates immediately fructifies. Similarly, a devotee who is completely depending on the Supreme Lord can also fulfill his wishes by the grace of the Lord. The Lord fulfills his wishes independently, but a devotee fulfills his wishes, you know, small h. Simply by being dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, as soon as Dhruva Maharaj thought of his poor mother, he was assured by the associates of Vishnu that Suniti was also going to Vaikuntha Loka in another plane. Dhruva Maharaj had thought that he was going alone to Vaikuntha Loka, leaving behind his mother, which was not very auspicious because people would criticize him for going alone to Vaikuntha Loka and not carrying with him Suniti, who had given him so much. But Dhruva also considered that he was not personally the supreme. Therefore, if Krishna fulfilled his desire, only then would it be possible. Krishna could immediately understand his mind, and he told Dhruva that his mother was also going along with him. This incident proves that a pure devotee like Dhruva Maharaj can fulfill all his desires. By the grace of the Lord, he becomes exactly like the Lord, and thus whenever he thinks of anything, his wish is immediately fulfilled.
Om Jnana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasavi Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
So the verse again, Dhruva was seated in the transcendental airplane, which was just about to start, when he remembered his poor mother, Suniti. He thought to himself, how shall I go alone to the Vaikuntha planet and leave behind my poor mother? So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, Suniti, however, being a woman, and especially his mother, could not become Dhruva Maharaj's, Diksha Guru. So sometimes, people have, questions about this. Sometimes people have questions about this, particular sentence. Does it mean, women can or cannot become gurus in the, international, society for Krishna consciousness? So, about 2 years ago, the GBC asked its Shastra Advisory Committee, of which I'm a member, to do some research on this topic. And we produced a statement which was later accepted by the Governing Body Commission. And basically we found that there are other places where Srila Prabhupada is directly asked, can women devotees become initiating spiritual masters in our society. And on one occasion in particular, a professor asked him this question specifically, and he said yes, and he gave the example of Janava Devi, the wife of Lord Nityananda. And so he said the real thing is the qualification, Ye Krishna Tattva Veta Se Guru Hoya. The real thing is the qualification. If somebody knows, Krishna, then they can become a spiritual master, either Shiksha Guru, Diksha Guru, or Patta Pradarshika, or Vartma Pradarshika Guru, the guru who shows the way initially. And in the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there have been several devotees in female bodies who have become initiating spiritual masters. One was, of course, as I mentioned, Janava Devi, the wife of Lord Nityananda. Of course, somebody might say, well, that's a very special case. But there are others as well who have also taken on that role. Hemalata Devi, who was the daughter of Srinivas Pandit, became a Diksha Guru to many great devotees. And also there was another devotee whose appearance day was celebrated in the Vaishnav calendar a few days ago, Ganga Mata Devi, sometimes called Ganga Mata Goswamini. And she began her life as a princess in a royal family in Bengal. Her name was Sachi Devi at that time. And she was very austere and renounced. When her parents tried to arrange a marriage for her, she said no, she didn't want to become married to any ordinary human.
And she went searching for a spiritual master. And in Vrindavan, she found Haridas Pandit, who was a guru coming in the line from Nityananda Prabhu. So when she demonstrated her great austerity and learning, this guru showed mercy on her and initiated her. And then later on his instruction, she went to Jagannath Puri. This was all maybe about two or three generations after the time of Lord Chaitanya. And she resided in the old house of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and restored it. And it said that many, many became her initiated disciples. And once on the occasion of the celebration of that takes place on the Makara Sankranti, the winter solstice, at Gangasagara, she desired to go there because it's customary to bathe in the Ganges at that time, at that place, the place where the Ganga meets the sea. It's a place, holy place in India. But she was in Jagannath Puri, however, said that the Ganges River entered her ashram, and she swam in that water to into the temple of Lord Jagannath, to Jagannath's lotus feet at night when the temple was locked. So when the pujaris found her there in the morning, they didn't understand how she'd gotten there. But when it was understood how she'd gotten there, she later got the name Ganga Mata Goswamini. So there are examples, a few examples, anyways, of women becoming initiating spiritual masters. There may have been more. There are more. Wasn't common. Wasn't a very common thing, apparently. But still, it did happen. So it appears that the main point here with Suniti was that, she was the mother of, Dhruva Maharaj. Just like, it's just customary that, gurus normally don't initiate their sons or daughters. So that appears to be the main point here. The Patta Pradarshika Guru is mentioned here, the devotee who initially shows one the way. So probably we all have in our experience some Vartma Pradarshika or Patta Pradarshika Guru who initially introduced us to Krishna consciousness. So in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj says that these various types of gurus, they are all manifestations of Krishna's mercy. Krishna's the original guru in the heart, the Chaitya guru. And the Chaitya guru manifests externally in these three forms, Vartma Pradarshika guru, Shiksha or instructing guru, and Diksha or initiating guru. And they are all according to our acharyas, manifestations of Krishna's mercy to the conditioned souls. Krishna makes his mercy available in those three forms. myself, I can consider a devotee named Daivi Shakti, Devi Dasi, as a Vartma Pradarshika guru. So I got a copy of Bhagavad Gita, from her at a Grateful Dead concert. That was my first, real connection with, the Krishna consciousness movement. as I said, we can probably all think of, devotees who were instrumental to our coming to Krishna consciousness if we weren't born in the Krishna consciousness movement. Some of us were. Some of you were. So the guru is a very important principle in spiritual life. Of course, today people have many kinds of personalities that they accept, kind of on the level of guru, what we would consider guru or teacher or guide. there are many kinds of famous personalities that people accept like that as guides to their lives, politicians, musicians, sports personalities, others. People become famous and then they attract followers. Of course, the greatest fame is to be a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is stated by our acharyas. I think Lord Chaitanya was asked, or did Lord Chaitanya ask Ramananda Roy? Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Roy, what is the greatest fame? And the most famous person is devotee of the Lord. I had some experience of that in South Africa recently. Of course, in terms of my external preaching, out in the world, I have a little bit of, tiny bit of fame as, Michael Cremo, the author of controversial books like Forbidden Archaeology and things like that. However, any devotee is actually more famous. Because I can walk through an airport, and nobody will know who I am. If I'm just there in my karmic, very few people anyways. But if I walk in my devotee clothes through an airport, then everybody immediately recognizes, oh, Hare Krishna. So, I was in Johannesburg Airport recently. I was doing some preaching in South Africa, and I was flying from Johannesburg to Durban, and I was in my devotee clothes, my dhoti and kurta. I was in the Johannesburg airport, and I saw this guy kind of like walking with about 30 South African policemen around him. And then I recognized who it was. It was Snoop Doggy Dogg. And he saw me standing in my with my dhoti and kurta on. He goes, so I went back to him. Oh, yeah? He seemed pious. I wasn't able to get that close to him because of the 30 South African policemen around him. They were guarding him very closely because he'd gotten into a big riot at Heathrow Airport. Him and his people had tried to crash a first-class lounge, and police were summoned, and his guards started throwing the policemen around like pillows. But anyway, so he was surrounded by policemen in Johannesburg Airport. But he did recognize, devotee. So devotees are famous. they're famous all around the world. So everywhere you go, you're more famous than most so-called famous people. So-called. Anyways, the greatest fame is to be recognized by Krishna as his devotee. So that's real lasting fame. Whereas this other type of material fame that some people have and most people aspire for is really not so significant in the ultimate sense. they may get some little amount of fame for some time and become, you know, influential in society. Like today, you know, the materialistic scientists are very influential in society. You know, people look at them as gurus, as knowers of the truth. You know, in the material society, if anybody, you know, wants to know the answer to some important question, you know, they no longer go to, you know, priests or monks or people like that. If they want to know, you know, the real truth, you know, if they want, they go to the people they consider to be the tattvadarshis, the knowers of the truth, you know, the materialistic scientists, which is very unfortunate, because then it becomes a situation like, you know, the blind leading the blind. You know, if the blind lead the blind, you know, they fall into a ditch. But, you know, these personalities are considered, you know, worshipable. So, I mean, Srila Prabhupada therefore understood that, you know, if the Krishna consciousness movement is going to become influential in the world, then the real leaders of society eventually have to become those who are actually tattvadarshis, you know, those who really understand the absolute truth. And that means, you know, the devotees of the Lord, you know, with knowledge coming from the Srimad Bhagavatam. I mean, that's why he, you know, writes in his preface, you know, to the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, that this knowledge in the Srimad Bhagavatam is meant to cause a spiritual revolution, you know, in the life of a misguided society. He said this knowledge is meant for the teachers, the leaders of society. So, you know, as, you know, followers of Srila Prabhupada, members of his International Society for Krishna Consciousness, you know, we each in our own way, you know, have our responsibility to propagate, you know, this knowledge, you know, to get it into the hands of people, to represent its importance to people in different areas of life, so that actually there can be real Brahmins, you know, real gurus to guide, you know, human society in the right direction. So now it's being misled, you know, by, you know, people with very little understanding of the real truth about matters. So it's at some point, you know, if the Krishna consciousness movement is going to become the leading force in society, then those who are now considered the intellectual leaders of society are going to have to be either converted or replaced, or somehow or other there's going to have to be some change. So in particular, they have this misguided concept of evolution, particularly human evolution. You know, they believe that, you know, if you trace your ancestry back, you know, if you go, you know, you trace your father and mother to your grandfather and grandmother and great-grandmother and great-grandfathers, you know, if you keep tracing your ancestry back, then eventually you're going to come to some ape men. And if you trace your ancestry further back than that, then you're going to come to some primitive apes and monkeys. And if you trace your ancestry further back, eventually you'll come to some amphibians and fish, some tiny one-celled creatures existing in the ocean, and finally just chemicals. You know, that's, you know, what they say. And, of course, if that's true, you know, like I was in, when I was in South Africa, I visited some of the, well, one of the sacred sites of modern science, the Sterkfontein Caves, where some fossils of some so-called missing links were found, you know, in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And you know, this cave is now designated you know, like a sacred site, a UN World Heritage Site. And it's called the Cradle of Humanity. It means this is where, you know, human beings took birth. Because we weren't always human beings, according to their philosophy. Once we were ape men. It's just amazing how the so-called, you know, most intelligent people in the world can be totally deluded by a completely false idea. It's really an amazing concept, you know, when you think about it, that the so-called most intelligent people in the world can be completely, totally wrong about such an important fact. But anyways, you know, at this place out in the countryside of South Africa, you know, they have a museum. And in this museum, which you go to before you're taken on parikrama to the place of the holy ancestors, is a museum where you're kind of invited to discover yourself. So what do you discover? Well, you discover, you know, that you're just a bunch of chemicals, really. You know, they have a big sign on the wall. It's a quote from a very atheistic biologist, evolutionary biologist named Richard Dawkins. And it says, in answer to this fundamental question, who are you? You know, well, you are simply a robot machine, you know, programmed to reproduce the selfish molecules called genes. And that's what you are, you know, according to the gurus of modern society. You are a robot machine programmed to reproduce the selfish molecules called genes. And it's no wonder that our whole human civilization has therefore become very materialistic in its goals. Yeah, because their gurus are telling them, you're simply material beings. You're here to produce and consume more and more material things. Of course, Krishna describes this whole sequence in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, in the 16th chapter. He says, asatyam apratishtam te jagat ahur anishvaram. You know, Krishna explains there's a type of philosopher who says, well, there's no God in control of the universe. There's no soul. Everything is matter, you know, simply combining in its own way. And then Krishna goes on to explain in that 16th chapter that people influenced by that philosophy will think that to gratify their senses until death is the main purpose of human life. And Krishna also says such people will be full of anxiety from the beginning of their life to the end, because they will be tortured by hundreds and thousands of unfulfilled and unfulfillable material desires. And Krishna also says such people will create horrible things meant to destroy the world. So, you know, 5,000 years after Krishna spoke those words, we can see, oh, it's all happening just according to that sequence. Because the dominant philosophy in the world today is there's no God in control of the universe. Everything's happening by chance. We're simply a, you know, an accident of evolution. And, you know, people under the influence of that idea have become very materialistic in their goals, and they have become full of anxiety, frustration. And they are creating a big mess. They are creating horrible things meant to destroy the world. You know, they're destroying the environment, engaged in so many conflicts over material resources. If that's going to change, then there has to be another kind of intellectual direction given to society by people who know the real truth about, you know, these important questions like, who am I? Where did I come from? You know, the Vedic literature tells us, aham brahmasmi, you know, we are spirit. It doesn't tell us, aham monkey or aham chemicals. You know, aham brahmasmi, we are spirit souls, part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Atato Brahma Jigyasa, you know, now is the time to inquire, you know, about the Absolute Truth, to perfect our lives, you know, on the basis of that knowledge. So for that purpose, you know, guidance is required. And Krishna gives that guidance. You know, he's the guru within the heart, but externally he appears in the form of, you know, the various kinds of spiritual masters, the initiation, the Shiksha gurus, the Vartma Pradarshika gurus. So in all those ways, you know, Krishna is trying to guide us. He's also guiding us through the Vedic literatures, you know, which are, you know, his teachings, his instructions to us. So by taking proper guidance, then we can, you know, achieve the real goal of human life, not just for ourselves individually, you know, which is one of the message given in this purport. Devotees are not simply interested in their own spiritual advancement. They want others also, all others actually, to have the chance, you know, to go back home, back to Godhead. So does anybody have any questions, comments? Archito.
Well, if there are no questions on the verse and purport, maybe you can give us a little synopsis of your latest trip. You were gone for quite some time. Maybe you can give us some highlights.
I go where I'm invited, so devotees in South Africa invited me to come there. And my preaching is based on my books, so I told them I have several books. Which one would you like to be the center of this, you know, particular tour? So they said The Hidden History of the Human Race, which is the abridged popular version of the book Forbidden Archaeology, and that book presents, you know, archaeological evidence that contradicts, you know, the Darwinian theory of human evolution. And so, you know, I asked them to arrange university lectures, temple lectures, whatever media types of interviews they could come up with. So they did that. And so I went. I arrived in South Africa on April 20th. You know, I stopped first in Johannesburg. And the Pretoria area. Yeah, so those two cities are there. And you know, I spoke at the University of Johannesburg, the University of Pretoria, the University, the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, which is one of the famous schools for study of human evolution. A lot of the scientists who have, you know, done important work in, you know, constructing the totally illusory concept of human evolution that they have did their work at that school. So it was very nice to be able to speak at those universities. I also spoke at the two temples that we have in that area. We have a temple in Pretoria, which is one of the capitals of South Africa. They have kind of a system where they have a legislative capital and an executive branch capital. But it's the place where all the embassies are. So in Pretoria, you know, our temple is on the street where they have most of the embassies, you know, foreign embassies. So the sign for our temple says Embassy of the Spiritual World. So I asked the temple president, do people come in asking for visas? Requesting political asylum? So actually, Srila Prabhupada did say all of our temples are like that. So you can say we've all come here to apply for our visas. Because actually, they have a strict immigration policy in Goloka Vrindavan. They guard the borders very carefully. It's not like you can find 12 million undocumented illegal aliens in Goloka Vrindavan. So maybe President Bush can take some lessons from Lord Krishna, you know, how to, if you want to get into that sort of thing. So actually you could say we've all come here to get our visas, you know, for that flight to Goloka Vrindavan. And we want permanent residency there. We don't just want a short-term visit. So in a sense, yes, all of our temples are embassies of the spiritual world, but they specifically have a sign there saying Embassy of the Spiritual World. It's very nice. And I mean, South Africa is it's a very big place in terms of, you know, Krishna consciousness. So we have there our temple in Pretoria, and then also one in a place called Lanesia, which is during the apartheid days in South Africa, the government made different cities as residences for people of different races and things like that. So this place, Lanesia, I think was one of the places where there were a lot of Indian people. So we have it still has a lot of Indian people living there. So there's a big temple there, modern temple that the devotees have constructed. But in South Africa, you find it's a very diverse place, and especially in the Krishna consciousness movement, it's diverse. There are Indian members, African members, more European type people members. So it's very, you know, diverse. So then after speaking at the universities and temples in that area, then I went to Durban, where, as many of you know, we have a very, you know, huge temple at Durban, and also a brand new, very big temple at a place called Phoenix. And these are very, you know, prominent temples in their cities, and devotees are very well known in South Africa, apparently very much appreciated by most people from all walks of life. So I spoke, you know, against Darwinism at universities in that area. The main university is called the University of KwaZulu-Natal, which has campuses all over that area. And so I spoke at most of the campuses. And, you know, the devotees have a very good program. They have a program they call Bhakti Yoga Society. So they have chapters of this Bhakti Yoga Society at practically every university, you know, in South Africa, in the cities where devotees have temples. And they have many devotees who are professors at these universities, who are graduate students, undergraduates, or people with university training who are out in the world and employed. So they have a very big presence, you know, at these universities, especially with these, you know, bhakti yoga societies. And it's very inspiring to see how they're, yeah, that's a big part of their preaching. And many of the people who join their movement come from these, you know, bhakti yoga societies at these universities. So some of the lectures that I gave were arranged by the Bhakti Yoga Society. Others were invitations from different departments of universities. For example, at one university in Durban, I was invited by the Faculty of Natural Sciences, you know, to speak to them, and all the heads, the professors who are heads of, you know, the various science departments in this university, they came, and along with their students. So some of the lectures were like that. Some were for the Bhakti Yoga Society. Some were for university departments. Some were also what they call university lectures. In other words, that the universities, you know, have lecture series, you know, where they invite speakers from all over the world to come. So some of the universities, I was part of the university lecture series. Quite good, practically every day. You know, I had lectures at universities. And then also, I was able to speak twice on South African national radio for an hour each time. So these radio programs, they go over the whole country, which has about 44 million people in it. So it was that was good. It was a prominent newspaper in Durban published an article. So then after spending about a week in that area, then I went to Cape Town. It was kind of like the last stop. Same thing there. Lots of university lectures. And then I also had a taped an appearance for a national television program there. It's very nice. So it was a nice opportunity to speak against Darwinism in South Africa and also to see how the Krishna consciousness movement is spreading there. It's a very big center of Krishna consciousness, South Africa. Very powerful, preaching going on there. So somebody had a question over here, and then we'll just stop after that.
And I know that within the species there are changes, evolution. But where does it jump the line where one species goes to another?
Well, there's no evidence that one species can change into another. I mean, you can take dogs, you can breed them. You can get big dogs, little dogs, short-haired dogs, long-haired dogs, but they always remain dogs. Now, if you could breed dogs and get a dog that could fly, I mean, that would be very interesting. But most of the changes that they are actually able to observe are changes like that, very minor, changes, You can breed horses, big ones, small ones. You can breed fish, big, small, this way, that way. You can change colors. You can change size. But basically, the kind of changes they observe, that we actually observe, are they're not like big changes like a dog that could fly or something like that.
Why are they accepted with such authority?
Well, it's Krishna within the heart, actually, in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's one place where I think Krishna's telling Uddhava, that he causes people to believe these things, and then according to the faith that people have, Krishna gives them a certain type of belief. And I mean, Srila Prabhupada said that Krishna gives the Mayavadis, the intelligence to misinterpret the obvious words of Bhagavad Gita so that it means something impersonal. When everywhere Krishna's saying, "I say this, I say that," Sarvasya chaham hriti sanavishto matis mritir gyanam apohanam cha. So Krishna's in the hearts of all living entities, and he gives them intelligence, knowledge, and forgetfulness according to how they surrender to him. So Krishna within the heart gives them a specific kind of intelligence, a specific kind of forgetfulness, how to forget Krishna, how to forget. So ultimately it's Krishna within the heart responding to their desires. But of course the point here that's being made in the purport, if we have a desire to change their mentality, Krishna can make it happen. Pure devotee like Srila Prabhupada, it was his desire that this mentality change. So Krishna can make that happen too. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.